Welcome back from spring break. You can see your exam scores. I posted the range of scores on the homepage, so you can see that. Your midterm grades are what you would get if we raised the grades on the scores now. So for the most part, I'm happy with how everyone did, and that's where things are at. So any questions before we go on? Okay. So we were talking before the break about small-scale problems, galaxies in the standard Coldback matter Lambda paradigm. We didn't quite get all the way through that. We haven't talked about the too-big-to-fail problem, or the planes of satellites problem. But I think we should move ahead and talk about other things. So maybe we'll come back to some of those things or not. But those are sort of main check things that you should have heard before. And so first I want to start just with the timing argument in the local group. Say local group, but really we mean just the orbits of the Milky Way and Andromeda, right? So the basic picture is, you know, we're talking about the formation of an individual galaxy. It has its own little dark matter halo, and initially that dark matter halo is expanding along with the rest of the universe, and it recollapses to form a halo. The baryons subsequently fall in, they sink in, form a galaxy, all that fun stuff we were talking about before. But of course there are other galaxies in the universe, and in our own local group, the two big bruisers are the Milky Way and Andromeda. They are by far and away the most massive galaxies. There are lots and lots, dozens of dwarf galaxies, but almost all of the mass is in these two objects. So they have to form galaxies in the same way, but they also interact, and so initially they were presumably expanding apart with the rest of the universe, but if the local group is a bound entity, then eventually they will also reach a maximum expansion and recollapse. So how long does that take? Does it happen at all? Well, we can go out and measure redshifts. Of course, in general, the universe is expanding, so most galaxies are redshifted, but M31 is approaching us. We measure this very well. Coming out is about 109 kilometers per second, and that's corrected to the frame of the center of the Milky Way. We measure it from our location at the sun. We know what the solar motion is, and in fact, that's the biggest uncertainty of this, is how do we translate from our location in the sun to the frame at the center of the Milky Way. But so this turnaround has already happened. Andromeda's coming at us, and eventually will crash into us, given a few giga years. And exactly when that happens depends. It could also have some tangential velocity, right? It doesn't have to be a purely radial orbit. There are not great constraints on its tangential velocity. It's thought to be small. But the upper limit at 2 sigma is only like 60 kilometers a second or something now, at 3 sigma, 2 sigma. So there might be some tangential velocity component. And that's hard to measure, of course, because to measure that you need proper motions. So you actually need to see stars moving on the sky, and Andromeda's a long way away. This is about 770 KPC. So some people say 780, some say 750, it's in there, right? So, and there are other weird things, like most of the dwarfs associated with Andromeda are on the side that facing us. There's a paucity on the other side. And we can measure relative distances quite well, even if calibrating the absolute distance is always a challenge. So that's weird, but we won't think about that anymore. We just care about the mass of this thing and this thing and what their total orbits is. And so this is small, so we'll ignore it and pretend like the orbit is, in fact, radial. It just started expanding apart, and then we're going to collapse back together. And so now we have to work out the timing of how that works. And this argument goes all the way back to Kahn and Wolter. It wouldn't surprise me if somebody else did it first, but this is the first reference I know of. 1959.
Yeah. What caused it to come back?
It's just if it has enough mass, right? So just as we did for one galaxy, we can imagine putting our Gaussian pillbox around this, we'll now call the halo of the local group. And the question is, locally, if omega matter for that is greater than one, right? So if it's not, it'll never recollapse. It'll just expand away. And the fact that Andromeda is, in fact, blue-shifted coming at us tells us that locally this thing is gravitationally bound and is coming back at us. And in fact, you could imagine that the local group had had time enough to virialize, and it had sloshed back and forth several times, right? But that would require a much higher mass just to get there. So this is sort of a lower limit on what's going on. And most people are of the opinion that this hasn't happened yet, that we're on first infall. Part of the reason for that is that we're nice, pretty spiral galaxies still. When these things smack into each other, they'll merge if there's enough dynamical friction between their dark matter halos. Other thing I haven't gotten to yet. But basically, in order for these things to merge, you need the dynamical friction from the dark matter halos. The stars by themselves would just go right through each other and keep going. Right, so there's a lot of orbital energy that needs to get absorbed in order for them to stick. And the dark matter halo is what sucks that up through a process of dynamical friction. So we anticipate that in a few giga years, Andromeda will get here and will be one of those interacting galaxies that you see pretty pictures of from the ARP Atlas. And afterwards, it'll settle down into some merger remnant, which may very well be an elliptical galaxy. So this process of merging and that happening, spiral galaxies getting transformed into ellipticals is not yet done. Though it is certainly slowed down. But yeah, it didn't have to be that way. It could have been that there wasn't enough mass in these things, and we just kept expanding away. And we only infer that because that's what we observe. We see it coming at us. And so the question is where in its orbit is. Now, we have told you a lot about orbits as students, and how Kepler's laws tells you the shape and the orientation, all that sort of thing, an elliptical orbit. But where you are along the orbit at any given moment is a little trickier. We usually blow that off. So the separation between the two objects, so R is now going to be the distance between us and M31. And we're simplifying this to talk about just a radial orbit, so we don't have to worry about the tangential motion. Done that simplification yet, because E is the eccentricity of the orbit, right? So for a purely radial orbit, the eccentricity is 1. Right? For a circular orbit, it's 0. And then it's always the same radius away from us. Okay, so basically, this radial axis and the physical picture is that we started out arbitrarily close together at the beginning of the universe, so that sets the time scale. And we went out to some maximum radius, and now we're moving towards each other again, and so we've had some time to move back in from that maximum extent. So we're in some orbit that, in the absence of dynamical friction, would just continue, and we would just oscillate forever there. And this is the first infall, so we have not yet gotten back to the origin. And so the phase of this orbit is something more, like the whole thing would be 2 pi, 360 degrees. That's 180 degrees. And so it's somewhere between pi and 2 pi, because it's coming at us. And that's what eta there is. Eta is the development parameter which basically tells you how far along the course of the orbit you are. It's all right. Orbits are some elliptical things. So in general, one defines the pericenter as the zero, and then you go around as there's pi, and there's some point you are. And so here you are at some point along that orbit that just is cyclic. And so it goes 0 to 2 pi in phase. Over and over and over again. All right. So where are we now? So it's convenient to define this angle eta is the development parameter, because that's really what you want to know is where along the orbit you are. The time is not a simple thing, right? Just remember Kepler, you're moving fast near the pericenter and slow nearing the epicenter. You're doing that sort of thing. So there is some mapping between the development parameter and linear time. So the free factor you recognize from Kepler's law, p squared equals a cubed, except now the mass is the sum of the mass of the two galaxies rather than the mass of the sun. And when the units of Kepler's laws are solar system units, right, years and astronomical units, this is the mass of the sun, and that is just one in solar units, so that goes away. But in general, you have that term for other masses. And that's just the free factor that sets the period of the entire orbit, so where you are along there, is that, it's related to the time derivative of that for good reason. All right, so we've defined the development angle. Remember, we have these other quantities. The semi-major axis of the ellipse, and the eccentricity is how pointy it is, with e goes to 1 for a radial orbit. E greater than 1 is a hyperbolic orbit, which is not bound, so it just goes away again. And of course, 0 is a circular orbit. Okay, so we can differentiate this expression. Time and how time is related to this development parameter. the derivative of the radial coordinate, so it's basically a distance over a time, and here, time knot is the time since the last pericenter passage in general, or in this case, it's the age of the universe. That's why it's called the timing argument. Basically, how far could you have made it in the orbit since you started out at the origin and everything started out moving apart. So that initial condition is the expansion of the universe. And that has some you can see why we don't teach you the details of where things are in their orbits. Right. Now you're in the big league, so you get to worry about these things. And this was all worked out in the centuries after Kepler, in great detail, with all sorts of really fancy numerical approaches that you could do by hand to solve this. That's how people notice things like the perturbations and the orbit of Uranus that led to the detection of Neptune. Not just the basic orbit, but that there were perturbations from the other planets, plus some excess perturbation that was unexplained. Really an impressive feat, especially without computers. Now we type this all into a computer and forget how it works. I want you to see how this works, and you'll find that out on the next homework, which is due a week. All right, but this is basically just an expression. We're assuming E is 1 to make it easy, and then it's basically how long does it take to reach this infall velocity, right? So we measure R dot, that's what this is, right? This is the radial velocity here, dr dt, and we see it's coming at us, and we know how far away it is, 770 or whatever I see on the homework, 750, 780, one of those numbers. We know what the age of the universe is. So that lets us work out what the sum of the masses is. So that's basically an estimator of the mass of the local group, i.e. how much mass does there have to be in the whole system for this to where it is at in the development of this orbit. Remember, the mass of the Milky Way is of order 10 to the 12. Andromeda is presumably comparable to that, so that's a number of, you shouldn't get a number smaller than that. You might get a number bigger than that. Should be of that order of magnitude. Okay, there is not. Welcome back from spring break. The orbit theory before we get going. Okay.
Yeah, I may have just missed this, but like, timing argument for what? Like, I understand what just happened, but what is this an argument for?
It's that where we are in the phase of the orbit. So it's a timing argument as a constraint on the mass of the local group, of the Milky Way and Andromeda. Now, in general, there are lots of dwarf galaxies, so you could do a more elaborate calculation and ask what you need to explain the velocities of all the dwarfs in the local groups, as well as the big bruisers. And that requires a more complex approach, a numerical approach, and sometimes called the numerical action method, minimize the action. And so Jim Peebles and his collaborators broke such a code and have done that. And what you find is that, yeah, most of the mass is in the big things like you'd expect. Getting all the orbits of all the objects right is tough. There's always some outlier. You think you got most of them, and then there's one like, oh, why is Leo T have this vector when it should do something else? But, for the most part, it seems to work out. One funny thing, and then it will come back towards the end of the lecture if we get that far, is that the sum of mass within the local group, is a bit low for the total mass density of the universe. That's not unusual, but that's basically just saying, okay, now we know the mass of the local group, what is its omega matter on average? But mostly, that's the group scale, so that is our bow to the group scale. Now I want to talk about clusters, of which groups are just a small example. The local group, having two big galaxies, is being the smallest example you can have. And some people consider it to be a binary system with Andromeda having its cloud of satellite galaxies. The Milky Way has its cloud, and that's sort of two separate dark matter halos. But there's also M33, which is pretty big, and the LMC coming in, so maybe it's more of a group. But we also get things like this, which is a cluster of galaxies observed by JWST. This was among the very first things that it did, and this cluster was selected as a target because it was already known to be a big gravitational lens. And so not only can one measure the lensing, but you can also hope to detect very high redshift galaxies that have been magnified that you would not otherwise be able to see. So that was part of the reasoning for selecting this sample. But I'm just using it as an illustration here because it's real pretty. But also, there are four distinct ways that we detect the mass discrepancy in clusters of galaxies. There's the velocity dispersion, which we use in the virial mass estimator, which we've talked about. There's the hydrostatic equilibrium of the X-ray gas, which I want to talk about some more. It's gravitational lensing illustrated here. And you can see by eye all these arcs. The red arcs are basically background galaxies whose images have been distorted by the gravity of this foreground cluster as it passes by. So the white things are galaxies at the in the cluster, and the red things are background galaxies. And the things with hexagonal spikes are stars. Point sources, of course, just have that point spread function because the JWST is built by tiling together hexagonal mirrors. So you get that characteristic thing. So you can always tell the difference between an HST image and a JWST image because HST is the traditional four things from the support spikes. You get other things in the JWST point spread function. It's this hexagonal pattern. It really sticks out. And I thought there's one right here. Here's a galaxy, but it also has a faint hex pattern. That's probably an active galactic nuclei. It has a core bright enough to give you that point spread function. There's another one. So I don't know if those are all AGN, but they have enough point-like nature at their center to give you that kind of pattern. It could just be a very spiky light distribution. But you see lots of galaxies here, lots of very foreground stars, and then lots of background galaxies. And I'm sure somebody sweated very hard to get the color balance right so you can tell by eye what's background and what's foreground. And you can see lots of morphological details. There are spiral galaxies here. Notice that the spiral galaxies tend not to be right down at the middle. Of course, you don't know the depth, so I'm going to guess that one is either a little in the foreground or the background, because right down in the core, it's all elliptical galaxies. And that's a famous result, that there is a morphology density relation, that the densest regions tend to host elliptical galaxies. And the later type galaxies, like spirals, tend not to be there in less dense regions. That's cool to look at. How do we measure it? Well, so we've talked about the virial mass estimator before. So you measure the velocity dispersion. That is, you would go and measure the redshift of each of these galaxies in the clusters. You would measure the radius that encloses half of the light. use the redshifts to measure out what, basically, what is the RMS variation in the redshifts. That gives you the velocity dispersion, the half-life radius, and then there's your virial mass estimator. There's a whole literature on how to do this in the limit of not many objects. There are other estimators you can come up with, and you can work very hard to tweak this prefactor. Is it 2? Is it 3? Something like that. And sometimes that's worthwhile, but I say that mostly just so you know this is not the one and only way of doing it. It's just a sort of simplest way to think about it. Okay, then there's the hydrostatic equilibrium of the X-ray gas. So the gravitational potential, V squared, goes as gm over r. Right? Whole course is V squared, goes as gm over r. But to contain the hot X-ray gas, then you need to satisfy this condition. There's the thermal energy, Boltzmann's constant times the temperature, which is millions of degrees Kelvin, divided by the typical weight of a particle. That's the proton mass, and that's the mean molecular weight. The proton isn't quite the average particle in there, so there's some numerical thing that's a little bigger than one. But again, that's KTM, that's basically the kinetic energy. And then you see these logarithmic terms again, and remember they look nasty, but they're really very simple. The temperature gradient, often in doing this work, we assume that the temperature is isothermal, and therefore by assumption the gradient is zero, and that term is zero, so that's easy. Of course, whether that's a valid assumption or not is another question. And then the density profile of tracers, that's just the same beast that we met in the when talking about the genes equation. And so you want to know how the X-ray gas density profile falls off. But say it's a power law. Say the density rho goes as r to the minus 3, like the other parts of an NFW halo, so that seems like a reasonable guess. Well, then the logarithmic derivative is just that power. So that whole thing is minus 3 if rho goes as r to the minus 3. So if that's 0 and that's minus 3, come out, that makes that a positive. So it's basically 3 becomes your prefactor. That's the whole thing. So it's not hard. Yeah.
What do you mean we assume that it's isothermal? Like on what scale?
So you got a big ball of plasma that is the cluster, and you're just assuming that the thermal temperature of the gas is the same across the whole thing.
Okay.
So that's all isothermal means, the same temperature.
Just the gas?
Yes, and we'll talk about the distinction between the gas and the velocities, because you can think about the velocity dispersion of the galaxies as a gas, and you would guess, perhaps, that there should be an partition, a relative equitative partition between those things, and it's close to that limit. But you can measure that by measuring this profile, because the gas might be more or less extended than the galaxies. Doesn't have to be exactly kind of a partition. Okay. But so basically, you know, it's again balancing the gravitational potential against the kinetic energy represented by the temperature. That's really all it boils down to. So temperature goes as V squared. Same idea, just looking different looking equation. Still it's really the same physics. Another way of doing this is quite distinct, is gravitational lensing. I don't think we'll get to talking about the details of that today, but this is an astronomer's form of writing it. So basically the deflection angle that you see, right, so these things have some radius of curvature. You can think of it as having the light of having been deflected, so that image has been moved from its original location, because if there were no lens in the way, it would just appear there on the sky. But in fact, it's been bent in its progress towards us, and so it appears in a slightly different position on the sky. And the amount of that bend depends on the enclosed mass within that arc and the impact parameter, physically, what is the separation between the lensing mass and the light path that's trying to go by it. And that gm over velocity squared, in this case the speed of light, that's given the potential, and now in the relativistic bracing, but it's still the gravitational potential normalized to the speed of light. And so that translates to a mass enclosed within those arcs. Each one is a separate measure. In principle, you can map it out in great detail. In practice, it's hard to do. But basically, you get 10 to the 14 solar masses. Now we're just going to scale everything astronomically. So when that angle is 30 arc seconds, square there. So basically, the bigger the bend angle, the bigger the mass. That makes sense, right? More mass bends the light rays more. And then these distances are basically the distance to the lens, the distance to the source, the distance between the two, scaled to now to gigaparsec. So this is something that really only happens on cosmic scales. And then finally, there's the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. If you have a plasma of a ball of plasma and photons go through it, they can get a boost from the Compton effect, and that is quantified there. So we won't get that today, but we'll get to it soon. Okay, so that second example, hydrostatic equilibrium. Many rich clusters of galaxies have X-ray emission associated with them. So when Zwicky first started cataloging things, there were no X-ray telescopes. And so he was just saying, geez, there are a whole lot of galaxies together here. And then Abel did this more systematically later on. So every time you see a number like this, A2052, that's number 2052 in Abel's catalog, sort of the NGC of galaxy clusters. And then you have to worry about membership of the galaxies and so forth. But you can see all the red scale things. Those are the optical images, so you can see where the galaxies are. The white contours are the X-ray emission. So that's what an X-ray satellite sees, where an optical image sees individual galaxies and a whole bunch of them in the same area. The X-ray telescope just sees a big ball of gas. And so there is some surface brightness profile associated with that that one can quantify. Before doing that, you have to take care of the point sources. So X-ray telescopes see two basic kinds of things outside of our galaxy. One is this diffuse emission, which is from the hot intracluster medium. So there's a big ball of plasma surrounding and mixed in with the galaxies. And that is trying to cool just by Bergstrom breaking radiation, just free radiation, charged particles whizzing past each other. And that's the origin of these big contours that we see. Active galactic nuclei also emit X-rays, and they're very compact sources. They appear as point sources in here. So there's one, probably one there. And so you want to blot those out before you fit the contours of the ICM, because that's a different physical process. But there are methods to do that. Okay, so the physics of breaking radiation, what's going on here is you just have a very hot plasma, so lots of free nuclei, protons, helium, nuclei, alpha particles flowing around, whatever the metallicity of the gas is. So there's a few oxygens and irons and so forth. And then a whole bunch of electrons. And it's super hot, so things are very highly ionized. And so you basically just have free charges going past each other. And so this is just classical radiation. When charges interact, they accelerate each other, Coulomb's law, and the net effect of an electron losing by a nucleus or a proton is that there's an attraction. The proton says, hey, come on. And it gets slowed down a little bit by that, and that results in the emission of a photon. basically, the incoming velocity is greater than the outgoing velocity, and that difference in kinetic energy is emitted in a photon, and that's how the gas cools. Right? Energy is being lost by that process. And it got really hot because you have this deep potential well established by the dark matter in the first place. So when the gas falls into that dark matter halo, which remember has happened first, it gets shock heated. So it's basically just what happens, fall from infinity or somewhat very large distance onto a gravity well, and you pick up a lot of kinetic energy as you fall in. And then when you get there, you smack into the other gas, and so you shock heat to a temperature that's characteristic of the depth of the potential well. So that's why it's hot in the first place, and then it's trying to cool off this way. And there's a whole, again, subfield of how that actually happens. One has to worry about cooling core clusters because the cooling time is short down near the center of the cluster, not a Hubble time. So why is it still hot down there? And that is not something we will delve into deeply, but you should be aware that there are issues with how this is maintained at small radii. At large radii, the cooling times are long and you don't have to worry about it. All right, so there are a number of correlations observed for clusters and groups of galaxies. So just like individual galaxies obey things like the Tully-Fisher relation, the Faber-Jackson relation. Clusters of galaxies have their own scaling relations, which may or may not be related to those. And so here are a few plots taken from an annual review by John Mulcahy. It's back in 2000, which seems long ago, so I went looking around, and there does not appear to have been an update since then. But, you know, the physics is the same. So first, the velocity dispersion correlates with the temperature. What that means is that the motions of the galaxies are related to the thermal temperature of the gas, which just says they're sampling the same gravitational potential well, which is good. You would presume that that is the case. And let's see, groups or circles and triangles are clusters. The distinction between a group of galaxies and a cluster of galaxies is a little vague. But the local group is certainly a group, because there are only two big galaxies, and clusters have hundreds, even thousands of Milky Way mass galaxies. So that's one distinction. But where you stop calling it a group and start calling it a cluster is a bit arbitrary, but the things correlate more or less as you'd expect with a lot of scatter. So like I say, you don't have to have perfect equipartition between the energies of the two different components, which are not otherwise talking to each other very closely. All right. So the velocity dispersion of the galaxies also correlates with the luminosity of the X-ray gas. So you just ask how many X-rays are coming from that big ball of plasma. And again, that's basically good because it says the total luminosity, how much energy is being emitted, scales with the potential well in some way. There's, again, a lot of scatter there. You see the error bars, that accounts for some of it, but obviously all of it. And the groups are smaller or less luminous. And in fact, there are groups, like the Milky Way, where there is no perceptible X-ray emission. So by construction, they are not on this. They have zero X-ray gas. And so it is a bit of a puzzle to me when these objects acquire their gas, and when it gets heated up, and how often it's true. But in general, the richest clusters seem to always have the X-ray gas associated with it. And then the X-ray luminosity correlates with the temperature, and that's pretty much what you'd expect. You do see groups fall off of this theoretical relation, And that's related to what I just said, that they don't all have as much gas as you might expect from simple scaling arguments. And people make up all sorts of stories as to why this is the case. Included something called preheating, which, as near as I can tell, is just magic words to make everything work out. I don't understand what it means. And I literally asked some very eminent expert what he meant by that was, and he was like, I was hoping you'd tell me. So, but that is a term you will hear every once in a while. We will not worry about those details. We want to understand what the constraint on the overall gravitational potential is, and then what it tells us about the necessary dark matter content. Okay, so now we're talking about the X-ray data and how do we deal with that. So you have a surface brightness profile. It's basically the same game that we play with galaxies. You fit ellipses to the surface brightness as it falls off. And whereas spiral galaxies are well fit by the exponential disk profile, clusters are generally fit by what's called a beta model. And you could have just done this empirically, but we put a bit of theory in it, and so beta is this exponent, and that's what we fit for, along with a core radius. So there's a central surface brightness. How bright does it get in the center? What is the core radius of that gas distribution? And that, together with beta, gives you the shape of that fall off. And so beta appears up here in this kind of precious way. It's essentially just a power law, right, given the core radius. And you can make it a pure power law by making the core radius arbitrarily small. But anyway, this is a three-parameter fitting function that works decently well. And it is so-called beta model because beta is chosen to have a particular physical meaning, which is the ratio of the specific energy in the galaxies to the specific energy of the hot gas, the kinetic energy per unit mass of the objects. Right? So this is basically the ratio of kinetic energies, how much of it is in galaxies, how much is in the hot gas. But we normalize it by the total mass because, as we'll see, there's a lot more mass in the gas than in the galaxies. So that's what the specific means. It's just normalized to the mass. So it's the ratio of those energies in some sense, taking account for the fact that there are very different masses in the systems. And that is related to, okay, what is the mass of things? So there's a velocity squared again, right? That's the velocity dispersion, the kinetic energy in the motion of the galaxies, and then there's the inverse of kT over m, right? So that's the thermal kinetic energy, thermal energy there, per unit mass. They're basically just kinetic energy ratios. So there's the definition of those things. The mass mp is just the mass of the proton. The average particle in the plasma is not a proton, it's a little bit heavier than that because there's some helium and other stuff out there. So there is a mean molecular weight, which is basically a number of order one, but a little bigger than one, like it's of order 1.6 or something like that. And metallicity dependent, but it's not strongly metallicity dependent because it's mostly hydrogen and helium, plus a little bit of other things. Sigma is the line-of-sight velocity dispersion, the same one we've always talked about. Get back there. There you go. And the temperature is that of the intracluster medium, which is the big ball of plasma. So like I say, we usually assume that is the same temperature throughout. This stuff typically extends around a megaparsec in size, so that's a pretty big assumption. It could vary, and it's just hard to observe well enough to see that temperature variation. when it has been done, for clusters like Perseus, you do see variations. So that's going to affect the prefactor a little bit. And typically, when you work out what this power law is, you get 2/3. So it's not quite one, but it's close. And this number, it does vary. It tends to be closer to one when things are well measured in clusters, but tends to be lower in groups where we have that, bit of a turn down between the X-ray luminosity and velocity dispersion slash temperature relation. Okay, but those are just the quantities that go into this. There's nothing mysterious about them. All right, so the mass estimator that we use now, that is, what is the enclosed mass as a function of radius? You go to that outer contour, you fit your beta model, and we get infer the three-dimensional density profile of the hot gas, rho of R, by deprojecting the beta model. We are, of course, assuming that it is spherical when we do that, and so that what we see as the X-ray contours in two dimensions is just the projection on the sky of that 3D ball of plasma, which is what the beta model helps us get, right? So we get rho of R from that beta model. We need, in principle, to know the temperature gradient. And in principle, you can do that with resolved X-ray observations. Just to say there are not many clusters that are close enough to really do that well. And because to do that, you need a spectrum of every spot. Usually you can get a spectrum of the whole thing, but not of each spot. And so here's an example of several different X-ray spectra. The wavelength here is in terms of energy and KeV, so it goes from a tenth of a KeV to 10 KeV. These are hard photon X-rays. And so you have 1, 3, and 9 KeV, and obviously as the temperature goes up, you get more hard photons. So the temperature is pretty well fit. It's just a matter of resolving it. That is to say, you can fit the overall shape of this and know the temperature of the entire cluster pretty well. It's harder to say what is the temperature of this spot or that spot or that spot, because there's not a lot of signal, as you can see, just by looking at this. You also see some real bumps and lines and so forth. There are all sorts of atomic transitions deep inside, you know, basically iron K-alpha lines and things like that. When you have most of the electrons stripped off of iron, but there's still some stuck on there, and so you have really exotic atomic transitions, and those are all over the place. So you see those as lines in the X-ray spectrum. Okay, so now you can translate that to masses and hence gas fraction. So the total amount of gas there is proportional to the luminosity, X-ray luminosity. You add it up, ask how many particles at that temperature you need to make that many X-rays. That tells you the total amount of gas. You can use that hydrostatic equilibrium equation to figure out what the total mass is, and hence work out what the gas fraction is. So this is the ratio of X-ray emitting gas mass to the dynamical mass inferred, i.e. how much do you need to hold that down? This is really high temperature. It'll boil off in the intergalactic space on a very short time scale unless you have a lot of mass to hold it down. And this is chosen at R500. So at 500 is the same thing we've talked about, the overdensity, but it's 500 instead of 200 because 500 isn't as far out. And that's basically how far out these kind of data typically go. So it's a choice of convenience observationally. And so this is the gas fraction as a function of the total mass within that, so not independent. But you can see the total mass within that radius from hydrostatic equilibrium ranges from 10 to the 13 to 10 to the 15. Remember, the Milky Way is about 10 to the 12. Right, so 10 to the 13 is a pretty small group. And there are no points down there. You get up close to 10 to the 14, then you start to have X-ray emitting groups and all the way out to clusters. And notice that this is a linearly rising function. So you have relatively more of the total mass in the form of this hot gas for the highest mass clusters around 10 to the 15 solar masses. Now, this is most of the mass, baryonic mass in the system, so a lot of times people just talk about that, and I picked this one because they actually worried about the stellar fraction, count up how much mass is in galaxies, and so again, the same mass, but look at the scale now. You have to zoom here, this only goes 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15, and it only goes up to 0.06. So it's basically the bottom right corner of this diagram. The star fraction just isn't that high. The gas outweighs the stars in these systems. So it's not like you'd be swimming in the plasma if you were out in intergalactic space within these clusters. The intercluster medium is still a very low density, but is a big ball of plasma over a large volume, a megaparsec or so. So there, it adds up to a lot. And the baryons out there actually add up to more than is in the galaxies. And interestingly, as you go to higher mass clusters, the stellar fraction goes down. So the fraction of baryonic mass that is in the stars in the galaxies is pretty small, only a couple percent, maybe 5% for the lower mass things, right? So, even though we see them as groups of galaxies on the sky, call them clusters of galaxies, really they're balls of plasma that happen to have some galaxies mixed in. Most of the normal stuff is there. And of course, really, they're dark matter halos with all of those components. And the quantities are different. So that's, we go up in mass, the gas fraction is going up, stellar fraction is going down. So what happens if we add them up? So this is the same plot from the same paper. Up top we have the gas fraction and the stellar fraction plotted together. And also noted is that line is the universal baryon fraction as estimated by Fitts to the CMB power spectrum observed at the Planck. And it's about 0.16, 0.17. That is to say, the ratio of normal matter to all the mass, including the dark matter and the baryons, is about 17%. That's the cosmic baryon fraction. And so you can see for a Planck cosmology, the high mass clusters are about right. That is to say, these biggest clusters, 10 to 15 solar masses, seem to have a baryon fraction that is representative of the entire universe. And it's all in that hot gas. None of it's in the stars for any practical purposes. For the lower mass clusters, the stars are subdominant, but they're not negligible, so you have to add them up. So this lower plot is the baryon fraction where you've added the stars and the gas. And again, you get the same answer for the high mass things. They're about right, but they're a bit low for the individual groups. You're not actually getting the whole that you would think you would get. And if this is all you looked at, you'd say, oh, that's fine and no big deal. Basically, everything is accounted for. But there are two things to know. A small thing to know is that the gas fraction depends on the Hubble constant. And so this, by assuming the Planck cosmology, is assuming H0 is 67. And if you use 73 or something, then actually the gas fractions go down. They don't quite hit the cosmic fraction. So there's a lot of arguments about that, and And there are discussions of, well, just how close should it be? Should they be exactly on? And you can get hydrostatic effects that bias you tens of percent. So close enough for the high mass things. But this is not really true for low mass things, even though you can only barely begin to perceive it there, that difference is significant because you can expand the scale. And so here is the same data, basically,